Welcome to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. In this show, our hosts explore success and advancement through education by interviewing today's top leaders in the fields of education, business, and technology in order to provide insight into what it really takes to succeed. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com. All right, let's get into the show.
Welcome back to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking to Ken Newvin and Chris Maloney. Ken is the chairman of the Core Education Foundation and a member of its advisory council. Boasting over 25 years of experience in developing and leading innovative organizations. With a background in senior executive roles within the information technology industry, he has collaborated with Fortune 500 companies, startups, higher education institutions, and nonprofits. Ken's career path shifted toward the nonprofit sector, focusing on educational advancement and institutional governance. Notably, at the Charles Koch Foundation, he spearheaded significant grant-making initiatives in post-secondary education, cultivating advocates and fostering supportive environments for student success. Before his tenure at the Koch Foundation, Ken played a pivotal role at the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. And with nearly 8 years at Microsoft as Director of Public Sector Programs, Ken brings a wealth of experience to the table. He showcases a deep commitment to driving transformational change in education and organizational governance. It's a pleasure to welcome Chris Maloney back onto the podcast. Chris brings a diverse background to the discussion as the Associate Vice President and Associate Managing Principal for Consulting within the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. With a 100-year history of serving the higher education industry's governance and strategy needs, AGB is at the forefront of addressing leadership and strategic challenges in colleges and universities. Chris's extensive experience in leadership roles, research, and teaching enriches his contributions. Additionally, his involvement with the Core Education Foundation underscores his commitment to supporting non-traditional and underrepresented students in their pursuit of education and workforce opportunities. We're very excited to discuss upselling and reskilling with both Ken and Chris. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome back to Education and Empowerment Podcast. This afternoon, I have pleasure speaking to two amazing, wonderful international educators and professionals who have been in the field of education. There is so much to learn from them, and I'm truly excited to bring them both to our podcast together as a duo to talk about upskilling and reskilling and the state of higher education today. As you know, the United States is facing labor shortage. World Economic Forum is actually estimating that by 2025, there's going to be about 50% of, you know, employees that will need to do reskilling due to, you know, emerging technology and artificial intelligence and machine learning and all of that. I was wondering if, you know, Chris, you can provide some data and trends around enrollment and, you know, what you're seeing around degrees and credentials. What does it look like these days?
Thank you so much, Bach, for the opportunity to join you again. It's great to be with you and to participate in this conversation. So let me set the stage a little bit, and this will tee us up for a great conversation, I think. But when I get into conversations with folks increasingly, whether it's through AGB and the work we do there, or it's just sidebar conversations, I always start out with this one chart and really this one trend, which I think sums up exactly why we are where we are, at least with American higher education. And that's the birth rate decline that's taken place since the 1950s to the present. The reason that's important will become pretty clear pretty soon, but in the 50s or the early 50s, we were looking at around 24 births for every 1,000 people in the US population. Today, it's around 12, and it'll get down to as low as 10.
Wow.
That's really important because higher education and most of our colleges and universities were built around a model where we had very reliable and often growing numbers of traditional high school graduates flowing through and into our colleges and universities. That's not the case anymore. And it won't be the case in the future. We just don't have enough people, and immigration doesn't offset this, to continue sort of where we were and to support the sort of infrastructure and the number of institutions that we have, and so on and so forth down the line. When you look at where enrollment is now with traditional students, just a decade ago, 2010, 2011, we were at like 18 million students. We're at 15 million or so now. So think about that. In 10 years, 3 million students lost, right? And obviously, if you've been paying attention to what happened with the pandemic, we even experienced some more losses from that. Right. We haven't fully rebounded. There's a ton of interrelated issues and other drivers of change and disruptors that all feed from that sort of fundamental starting point, which is just fewer people to go around. So we've all heard about cost and affordability. That's a major concern, as is the debt burden of going to school. I've seen reports that have noted we've got tuition and fees that have doubled over the last decade. That impacts public institutions, private institutions. Related to cost and affordability, as we've all heard increasingly too, ROI, right? So what do I get if I'm going to spend anywhere up to $70,000 a year for a degree? That's really on the minds of students, as it should be. It's on the minds of their parents, their guardians, and people, I would say now, even compared to when I was going through my undergraduate, are so much more savvy and aware of what it means to take on student loan debt and how that might follow you around for a long time, how it might inhibit you from doing other things in your life that you want to do, buy a house, all that type of stuff. So people are very much focused on those dual issues of affordability, of return on investment. And people are thinking more and more about how what they go to school for is going to translate into a good job, a career, the income to pay back those loans if they've taken them out, the income to support a family. And then I won't even get into, I'll let, you know, Ken take that or you take that on where we are in the economy and inflation and just the cost of everything. There's so much mixed up together here. And I do think that reskilling, credentials, and all those other on-ramps are so important when you start thinking about cost and affordability and ROI concerns. And I know we'll get back there too. And then you have this issue of tuition discounting. So we've lost so many students, the costs have gone up. So what have we done? We'll slash the cost, right? So here's the sticker price, but then we're going to take that down a bit. In some institutions, and I've worked with some, we've spoken with many, tuition discount rates are as high as 70%. Right. Which is unbelievable. I think Nakubo did a study maybe a couple of years ago where the average was around 56%. So you think about what does it mean to be a sustainable college or university? Well, it's not going to work when you have fewer people and you're discounting everything at the same time. So I think I saw a statistic, and my colleague Paul Frigas mentioned this, there's about a third of institutions roughly that have a very uncertain financial future because of that. And so those institutions and many others, they need to be thinking differently about how do we get students in here? And that, again, brings us back to alternative pathways for education, credentials, nano degrees, all of that important stuff. And then this is where I'm going to segue over to the guy who's the real expert on this particular topic. Let's add to all of that the biggest bogey in the room, which is technology, right? And technological innovation and what that's doing literally every day in terms of disrupting where we are, and especially since 2020 with the pandemic. So I'm just going to set the stage there. I'm going to turn the mic over to my colleague, Ken.
Thanks, Chris Buck. It's good to see you too. That's a great segue, Chris. I agree absolutely with the data points you've used. In fact, I think we would all agree that many of those data points we've been sharing for at least the last 10 years to trustees and presidents, leadership teams, anybody who wanted to listen. And it seems like only over the last few years that people are starting to really listen and recognize the impact of these numbers. I think, as many of our colleagues in this area will share, the big institutions will probably survive and get bigger. It's unfortunate, though, that the smaller ones, the medium-sized ones across the country, will have a tendency to wither, if not go away. And that's a very sad fact. I think, Chris, you're right. There are probably a third of the institutions that are in some form of financial distress. And many of them are going to be the small to medium-sized institutions that we see across the country. And interestingly, many of these institutions are the hub of that community. They're usually, you know, located in rural areas, places that you and I wouldn't think about. Sometimes it takes 3.5 hours to get there from an airport or a train station. But needless to say, these institutions have 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 students visiting and participating, and that's the centerpiece of the community. So what happens to these institutions over time? So that's a big concern. With regard to workforce, I think one of the, you know, you sort of went into the skills aspect of things. I think it's important, but I think we need to be careful there. But I think from, if I'm an institution, or if we were working with an institution right now, the first recommendation I think we would all make is not only focus on your academic programming that's going to lead to a 2-year or 4-year degree, but come up with some very palatable, interesting, viable, sellable short-term programs, 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, 6 month programs. Not all of these things have to be accredited. Many of these are going to be in information technology, healthcare. We're seeing a lot now in advanced engineering techniques, et cetera. So a lot of these programs, the institutions are set up to be able to offer these. And there's not a need necessarily to worry about whether they're accredited or not, because in many instances, these certifications, these badges, whatever they may be, are going to be accepted by the employer nonetheless. So if you think about it that way, this is a version of a new revenue stream for these institutions, large and small. You've seen the large elites do these executive programs. They're six right. months to a year. Let's be frank, you know, are they accredited? Possibly, yes. But more importantly, it's an added revenue stream. And one has to look at the, from an institution standpoint, one has to look at it from, I hate to use the term, but there is a business model involved. It's revenue in and cost out. And you have to equate that somewhere else, somewhere along the way. And then you're dealing with a consumer, the potential student, either traditional or non-traditional. And as Chris, as you pointed out, many of these consumers are rather disappointed and they're looking away. And we've seen that in enrollment declines for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons for the enrollment decline. And one of the big ones, as you pointed out, Chris, we're not creating a lot of new people, and people like myself are aging out fast. So, you know, the next 10 to 15 years are going to be an interesting segue to what higher education or education overall looks like.
I totally agree, Ken. I don't want to cut you off there. I just data point to this issue, which is we're so oversupplied in terms of our capacity right now, right? We don't have enough demand to meet that capacity. I've seen figures that we've got 3 to 5 million seats where we're just empty, right? We're just waiting for those people. It comes back to this idea of, you know, viability, survivability of American higher ed in particular, because that's the focus we have right here. You're not going to do it chasing the same students you always chase, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So what are the things that get non-traditional students back there? What are things that get people who are already in the workforce back there? It's not to go get another 4-year degree or even a 2-year degree, probably. It's what can I do that helps me in my career, that gets me that promotion, that gets me set up for the next job, that gets me prepared to switch careers because what I'm doing right now is going to be replaced by something automated or AI driven, et cetera. It's those kinds of considerations that folks need to be thinking about. And I think we are starting to, but I also get the sense from all the conversations I have, and this might be true for you, Ken, we're just slow, right? It's a little bit slow in the evolution as an industry, not every institution. And we'll probably talk more about like the ASUs of the world, but generally a little slow. And you've got so many of those smaller institutions scattered all over the country who've existed for a long time with that very traditional model, who are now going, well, how do we play in this environment, right? And so I would just add that as a little bit more color there too.
Yeah, it's a great reminder, because if you think about it, the slowness is not picking on anybody. I think the three of us have had the great opportunity to work with institutional leaders across the country. It's like any industry. I come out of the IT community. So if you fall back or step back on your heels a little bit, somebody behind you is going to go right past you and cross the chasm in front of you, and they're on their way. Just look at Netflix versus Blockbuster. Netflix had the opportunity. They offered themselves to Blockbuster for $50 million. And the Blockbuster CEO is quoted as saying, "Don't see it. Don't see it." He had the opportunity, and he's gone now. His firm is gone, and look what happened to Netflix. So you have to be very aware of what's going on in your environment. So transformation is something we probably need to talk about a little bit. But, you know, when you talk about these alternative revenue streams, I think the institutions, large and small, are set up to be in a great place here. Offer a short-term program, and basically you have the individual, non-traditional, traditional, visiting your campus or participating with you online, hopefully in a viable online environment, where you can then stay with them and say, hey, that went well. Hope things are going well. Let's come back and do some more. Let's start focusing on credits. Let's start focusing on, would you like to go after a 2-year program or a 4-year program? We can line you up. We're not going to measure you by time. You know, you're part of the family. It takes a mindset change to do that. But if you think about it, that gives the institution the opportunity. I know it sounds very bold, but I'm all about boldest, audacious goals. And that is to tell a small institution, you could. It would be hard, but you could behave like an Arizona State University.
You could. And speaking of them, right? I mean, you know, kind of looking back at how higher ed transformed, you know, through technology, you know, I remember years coming in myself as an, you know, international exchange student and doing my internship, you know, to an organization called International Education Resources Network, which, you know, was apparently one of the first organizations that was facilitating, you know, Moscow, you know, New York, like back in like 19, you know, don't quote me on this, but like right after like World War II, you know, the first, so to speak, classroom to classroom, and you would think that technology was there starting out. And I'm sure that, you know, artificial intelligence too had started in some shape or form. But over the past, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years, you know, the compounded sort of benefit of that technology that was developed is truly changing the higher education landscape, right? And so I want to capitalize on those two words that you mentioned that really resonate with me as I'm sort of, you know, excited and very thrilled to get to know you, you know, through your background and both of you, transformation and opportunity. I think there's the definite need for, you know, alternative, you know, funding and access. And, you know, there is an organization that already does that and it's, you know, CORE Foundation. I was wondering if you can elaborate on the work of CORE. You know, what is the mission of the CORE? Like, what is the vision? You know, how did you come about, right? Like, what's your purpose and who does it serve? Tell us a little bit more about CORE.
Happy to. There are basically two components or two entities, best way to describe it. There is the CORE Education Services, which is a public benefit corporation. So that entity is an acting corporation. Their mission is to work with small to medium-sized institutions across the country to basically help them transform their business models. And the intent is to build an affiliation or a network of these institutions where they can leverage with each other the economies of scale. So that's CORE amazing. Can offer significant support from what I call in layman's terms, a very light touch or aspect of support to full hands-on support across all the functional areas. And from advancement to legal, to capital planning, to academic programming, to admissions, to enrollment, to marketing, you name it, all of the functional areas, there are experts and expertise and tools and capabilities that CORE Education PBC offers to these institutions. And as they line up, they basically are lining up because one, they're committing to being ready and willing to transform.
Right.
And depending upon their needs, it could be, as I say, it could be a light touch. Were they, for instance, in IT, very right. big area there, IT, they may, you know, institution may have their hands around it, but they need guidance and help and some strategic guidance. Or it could be another institution that's got Jimmy and Lori running on a server in the janitor's closet where you're going, okay, you need a lot of help and we can run that for you.
I see.
If it's admissions, we would identify that there may be some deficiencies in admissions and enrollment. And it could be because they haven't been able to find a good provost or a good individual to run the enrollment area or what have you. We'll actually put a person on site carrying their business card. And basically what's happening here is they're being, you know, all we're charging the public benefit corporation is charging is just the cost of that individual on site. It is not a reseller. It's a support services organization, the best way to describe it. But one of the areas they focus on with regard to revenue tactics is getting all of these institutions. And by the way, there are 20 institutions. The company started 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. There are already 20 institutions in the network. It's growing to 30 to 40 by the end of 2024. And then as you can see, the curve is becoming more exponential. So right. as the president will say, we're actually in hypergrowth mode since we only started this 2 years ago. Everybody is lighting up to us. A good example of this, being an old sales and marketing executive, right. We're not doing outbound calls anymore. the calls are coming in. Now we have to manage the hypergrowth of interest. That's a good problem to have. With regard to the foundation, why we're here, one area that we focus on is workforce development initiatives with each of these institutions. Right. If they're not doing it, they need to do it for all the reasons that were discussed earlier. And many, if not all, are signing up to it. We can offer the assistance. We can introduce them to employers. They may already have employer contacts, what have you. But the idea is to get the institution and the employer together. However, we quickly discovered, or the benefit corporation discovered, is there's no Title IV funding for these types of programs. There's no finance. You have to do this on a credit card or have the cash in hand. The Public Benefit Corporation created the CORE Foundation. It is a standalone 501c3. And we work with those institutions in CORE PBC's network, as well as employers, as well as major donors and small donors, to basically fill that gap. So we offer, through the foundation, a very long-term, easy-to-pay loan, very minimal down payment, $100, $150, to basically say, there's no credit check, no background check. If you're willing to sign this, we'll fund you. We'll get you, take the course, sign up to the course, get it done, because we have a relationship with the employer who's going to reimburse you. So we're all happy. But the intent here is we're working on building an evergreen fund internally that says for every, say, $1,000, what I'd like to tell an employer is this. Let me back up. $1,000 isn't going to go to one student. $1,000 will go to probably 10 students. So you have an impact of 10 times the traditional the traditional scholarship idea or a grant. There are no grants here. So we're attracting very large donors to participate. We're building a fund to continue to growth. We started this late last April. We've already worked with over 500 students. We're targeting about 4,000 this year for 2024. And then it continues to take off from there. So our focus now is, my job as the chair of the board is to focus on building up that evergreen fund so we can have that multiplier effect. We have the relationships with the institutions in play. That's relatively easy. And we're continuing to build more and more relationships with employers and their employer communities that want to participate in this, because they'll see somebody coming out of an institution with the right skill set. But here's the add-on. We're arguing is, you're getting somebody that's coming out of a higher education institution, so they're probably carrying along some soft skills as well. Sure. Which is what we call today durable skills. You're not hiring somebody that just went through a boot camp and has a little card that says, look what I did. You've got somebody coming from an accredited institution that said, this person is very good. And, we have a relationship with, you're getting a top-notch employee coming in. Right. With not only the hard skills, but, they're going to have some soft skills too. Because as we continue this discussion, that's a huge issue with the advent of technology and AI in particular. So the foundation has been around, as I said, a couple of years. It's growing fast. We're building the fund. We're working with 20 institutions to do this now, working with employers and major donors. And if anybody that's listening to this is interested in donating, you can find my contact info. We can have a conversation there.
That's amazing.
Again, it's to fulfill that gap around the whole workforce initiative. How do we get skilled people with the right capabilities? And in most instances, these are underserved individuals that just don't have a credit card to come up with $6,000 or $5,000. We've got that. We've got your back.
And a lot goes into that, right? I mean, you're thinking, I was quite recently, discovering, okay, do I go with my doctorate in educational leadership, or do I take, a couple of, courses that take, less time? Am I considering myself, reskilling, or is it, upskilling? I was wondering, maybe, Chris, you can shed some light onto, listeners listening to this episode, in your understanding and how you envision this, what is the definition of upskilling versus, reskilling, and how does organizations like, CORE Foundation are making the change from your perspective?
Well, I will definitely try to address those areas, but let me just back up and say, when I hear Ken describe what CORE is doing, Bach, even last time you and I were together and you described what Forestay does and right. others, it just reminds me, if you walk down the street, you ask the average person, what do you think about higher ed? They're going to think colleges and universities. The reality is higher ed as an industry is such a vast ecosystem. There are so many different players involved. So if you think of concentric circles, right, in that very center circle, you've got colleges and universities, systems, community colleges, every institution type, right in there. Next concentric circle out is just filled with, you know, associations like AGB, the Association of Governing Boards that I work for, NACUBO, ACE, you've got your statewide coordinating bodies, you've got your regional accreditors, right? All these different entities on that next ring out. And then you've got another ring outside that, and that's CORE, TC, all these other entities that are trying to serve higher ed in some way. You've got another concentric circle outside that, all these corporations and startups that are trying to do something there. It's just amazing how much is going into the industry in terms of inputs and innovative activities. I think it's inspiring in a lot of ways. And it ultimately comes back to everybody's trying to figure out how do we solve these fundamental problems, because everybody believes in it, right? All these people who are part of these corporations, these entities, in many ways have experienced what a higher ed degree can do for them and how it can open up doors and pathways, how impactful it can be on their lives, on communities, et cetera. And so there's all kinds of great people trying to do good things. It's always interesting to me to hear what other folks are doing and how they're approaching a particular slice of this issue, trying to solve for the fundamental problem, which is how do we keep this thing vibrant? How do we keep it going in a very rapidly changing landscape? So that's a long segue into getting back to your question, which is around, you know, what do you think of reskilling, upskilling, and all that? Reskilling is the thing that really interests me, because as you mentioned off the top, and I literally was just looking at that data point too from World Economic Forum, 50% of folks are going to need to reskill. I actually think it's probably more than that. I mean, that's, you know, I think that was data from 2021. When I look at how fast technology is scaling and evolving, it's moving quicker than we can appreciate in a lot of ways. Human beings have some challenges when it comes to truly appreciating changes like that. It often takes us a while to truly appreciate what's happening. I think it's going to be a lot more people than that. And before we jumped on here, I was even mentioning I have this interest where AI meets sort of robotics, right? And that synergy that's coming very quickly together. So reskilling, I think, is critically important for so many folks when you think about the future of work and how fast the economy is changing, the workforce, the needs of our companies, corporations, organizations are evolving and changing. Lots of people are going to have to be thinking about, how do I take what I know and evolve it? How do I add to what I've been doing? How do I shift gears a little bit? Colleges and universities are going to be critical players there in that reskilling movement. And I'd say, you know, our corporations are going to be too. They're already doing that in some ways, and they're offering those things. And then the work, of course, of the foundation, as Ken mentioned, critically important to filling that gap for folks who need to do that or want to do that and can't afford to do it, which is a really overlooked issue. Upskilling, I think, is slightly different. It's a nuanced difference, but it's really, you know, okay, I don't need to reskill to get the job or keep the job because it's changed, but I really need to add value to who I am, what I can bring to the table. For a lot of folks, it's, I want to take the next step. What is it that gets me to the next step or makes me a more viable candidate? Maybe it's, I want to stay in this career path, but not necessarily at this particular organization. Maybe I'm tapped out in terms of my potential here, but I know there's more potential in the industry or in that vertical. What is it I need to do to show folks out there that I can level up, so to speak? Yeah. You know, that's how I think of those two things. And I don't know if that rings true for you, Ken, or Bach.
It does. It does. I think you're right. I think it's far greater than 50% now, because that is older data, but it is pertinent nonetheless. But I think the world was rather shocked as to OpenAI's introduction of ChatGPT about this time last year when it started to go commercial. And I just read an interesting article in CIO magazine. My background is IT. And they're pointing out the early results of using artificial intelligence in code generation, writing code, developers. And they're finding significant productivity improvements across the board, especially, as they say, with junior developers. But they point out an interesting facet. The individuals need to learn how to manage the tool. In my instance, I'm going to equate it to the equivalent of a robot. You know, you want this robot to write the code because it's going to produce the code, but you've got to be able to tell it what you want the code to do. So if you don't have a way of articulating that, if you've been a hardcore coder and somebody gives you the spec, that's going away. You're going to be basically acting in the capacity of the other person that's writing the specs. As a writer of code, you're moving up or you're not doing anything, because there's going to be something that's going to write code 1,000 times faster than you ever would. And it will probably be more correct than not. But what you will need are the ability to articulate what's needed and then to be able to question or do quality assurance on the output. And if you don't know how to do that, I don't know what to tell you, but I go back to higher ed and say, well, anybody, but higher ed is in a sweet spot to basically say, you know, those durable skills, the ability to debate, articulate, share what's on your mind, as well as interpret, are going to be super, super important. So those people that have that background and then have the knowledge of how to use these tools, whatever they may be, they're going to be in a very powerful position. As I always say, AI is not replacing people. People that know AI are replacing people. And I think you're going to see a lot of that. But companies are basically, I don't know if you saw the article, it was about 4 months ago. Google's anticipating over the next few years, they're going to let go about 30,000 people. It's just not needed. They've automated the factory. It's amazing, but this is a world we're going into. So if you don't have those durable skills, the hard skills, do I need to know Python 5 years from now? Do I need to know how to do a PLI and AI in Amazon Web Services 5 years from now? Maybe not. Do I need to know the knowledge, have the knowledge of what they are? Probably. You know, what is it that they do? Yes. But you better be able to say or articulate to that dumb thing that's waiting for you to tell it to do something, you better be able to give it a good command. And I often question whenever I go out and present, I was presenting last week on the West Coast. First question I ask, how many here has written the prompt? Now, many people look at me like I have a duck on my head. Many other people have said, nope, already doing it. Wonderful. But you get a lot of people coming up afterwards saying, tell me more. Higher ed, I think, community colleges as well, are in a sweet spot to give this out. And I'll finish this off with an anecdote. A good friend of mine is working at one of the big three high-tech entities out there. One of the big ones has a huge market cap, if you know it, so you can figure out which of the three. He and I worked together in sales and marketing. We ran large groups where we worked together. He's now in charge of all of the public sector group, which includes all federal, all of the state and local business, and all of the higher education business. So he sent a memo that he wanted to draft, he was drafting to send out to his HR director, which was basically say, what I want to send to my hiring managers are the is the following request. Anybody that's client facing, whether they're sales, business development, customer support, an expert in the technology, if they're talking to the customer on their resume, which unfortunately is a proxy that we still use, we can get into that. That's another discussion. But on the resume, anybody that has performing arts or humanities, put them at the top of the list. Performing arts he wanted for priority. He says, we can train them on the technology. He said, the technology is changing every 3 months. I need people that are confident, that can go out and hold themselves up in front of strangers. I'll get them trained technically. That's our job. But I'm looking for well-rounded individuals, and I need them to be, you know, it's a hard skill. I mean, you know, it's hard work, you know, so, you know, you got to be attentive, got to be focused. All that. Where am I finding those? So that was his idea. The only thing I told him is a brilliant idea. I just don't know if HR is going to bless it, but it's a brilliant idea. But that also goes back to the point. The hard skills are super, super critical. The workforce needs are super critical. If you're upskilling, that's one thing. If you're reskilling, it's super important. But imagine if you had a small institution in the middle of Iowa say, you know, I can give them that credential, but I'm also going to tell the employer, but they're ready to, you know, they know how to use that antiquated thing called an email. They know how to use that antiquated thing called PowerPoint, because the employers are still looking for that. And they know how to hold themselves up in front of a meeting and things like that. We did that with these people. They're ready to go. That's going to be, I think, super important. Yeah, I'll shut up.
You're spot on a lot of that. I think I'll add a little bit, just bring in another aspect to this, which is not everybody likes this terminology, but I do think of, you know, your students as customers, right? So they are paying you for a service, for an experience, et cetera. I'm a huge proponent, as I think many people are, of meeting your customers or your students where they are, but also trying to really anticipate where they need to go. And I think that's the mindset that we need across the board in higher education. There's so much conversation right now, rightfully so, around mission, around yes. equity, fairness, and of course, around student outcomes, right? And that ties us right back to ROI and all those different yes. things. So if you're thinking about what does it mean if you're a board member, a trustee, if you're a leader, if you're at an institution, college or university, to be sort of thinking about the future and future focused, it's okay, how do we evolve our mission in the right way so we can continue to meet the needs and anticipate the needs of our students? How do we do that in a way that enables more people? And that's where, again, the Arizona State example is a great one. There are more people can access what it is that we have available to them. And how can we ensure that what we're able to provide them isn't just the social experience, but it's truly focused on outcomes across the board? So yes, job placement, career earnings, that's incredibly important to people because that's the world we live in, right? You need a job, you need money to get by, but there's all that other stuff that comes with going to college that's so important, right? The critical thinking skills, what Ken just mentioned, the soft skills that you right. get in a liberal arts education, which can sometimes get overshadowed and overlooked. How do I talk to people? How do I present something? How do I, you know, verbally do that? How do I present something in writing? All these important soft skills that are so critical out there. When you combine that with the right approach to the hard skill development, you have a great recipe for success there.
I was just going to tie back to the foundation. I think a good example of this is there's one person we talk about a lot, Rachel. I won't use her last name here, but she was a high school graduate. She had a little bit of community college. She had 10 years of work experience. She was a registered nurse in a memory care unit, and she was interested in getting an EKG certificate, sort of moving up. So a little bit of upskilling here, but also reskilling to a certain extent as well. Her employer was willing to give her reimbursement, but when you looked at her as a person, she was a working adult. She was a busy mother raising kids, single mom. Wanted to earn a little more money, enjoyed helping others, as you can see from her work, and was enjoying learning new skills for all the right reasons. But she could in no way afford the boot camp $2,000 upfront tuition. It was impossible to do. She got it through one of Core PBC's institutions, Regis College. The foundation jumped in and helped her get that financed with very minimal impact because we made sure the employer reimbursed her. So we basically, I hate to say the term, give the term, but we became the middleman, her advisor, her person to help her get through the gates without having to worry about, can I handle this financially? Many of us might look at a $5,000, $6,000 investment as that's not too bad. There are a lot of people where that is a lot of stuff for the rest of the month in a household. So that goes back to the foundation, but it goes to this individual. She went to an institution to get the resolution, and the institution saw the value of offering these types of certificates, working with employers directly. That's fascinating. Now we're going through Chris's Venn diagram, or what the circles of that go further and further out. When you get the corporations jumping back into it and saying, yeah, we'd like to participate, that's pretty cool. I would say that's been a weakness over the years, but we're seeing more of that now.
I mean, you brought a very good example of, you know, what reminded me of my, you know, graduate school years. So one of my classmates, she was from, you know, one of the African countries. And, you know, early on, I learned that there is this, you know, English phrase that takes a village to raise a child. So in a very, you know, informal conversation, I started asking her, I said, can you tell me what it means? And, you know, how were you able to afford education in the United States? And I was really fascinated to learn that the concept of, so to speak, the Evergreen Fund apparently exists there. And so she described that, you know, her entire family, maybe like 40 or 50 people have chipped in, you know, for her, like all the, you know, uncles and aunts and, you know, brothers and sisters, they chipped in for her education. So she was chosen to come and study there. And what fascinated me there was the fact that there are, you know, really innovative ways to address the skills gap, right? You know, whether it's just for a family or an organization or, you know, a community or, you know, an entire industry. And, you know, as I'm sort of looking forward and analyzing what's going on, like you mentioned earlier, I'm seeing that there's that fear. You know, what happens if this, you know, whole AI thing is going to replace us? And you made a very good comment about it's the people who know AI will praise the people that don't. And it's such a, you know, good statement that you made. And I'm wondering if maybe, you know, both of you can help set the stage on what's the future like then? I mean, you brought an example of, you know, so to speak, Rachel too. But let's take a moment to think of not just Rachel, but Rachel's, right? Like many people and many other young people who need to be reskilled or upskilled. You know, what kind of trends are we seeing? You know, is that, you know, would institutions be changing? Are there institutions that you are seeing now that you can bring as an example in this, you know, conversation? What's going to happen next? Where are we going?
Let me just jump in and share an example. Ken, happy to have you, you know, share examples too there. So back in January, so AGB, for those folks who are listening who don't know, we serve colleges and universities. They're members of AGB. We work with their governing boards and with their leadership teams, but we also work with what are called institutionally related foundations. So back in January, AGB had a big event called the Foundation Leadership Forum out in Los Angeles. One of the plenary sessions there had folks from Arizona State University and from their partners at, I believe it's Dreamscape Immersive. So what ASU is doing, and they showed a video, it was really amazing, but it makes you think, right? You go home after that and you're really thinking about the possibilities. So ASU is leveraging virtual reality technology in the classroom. Right now, mostly around sort of biology, going to expand into chemistry. So this is all being developed in collaboration with a private sector partner, Dreamscape. But it is mind-blowing when you think of the possibilities, right? So that's the merging of technology with these needs to better serve students, to help give them the skills they need, help them develop those skills in a more meaningful way. So again, keeping in mind who are students nowadays and what are they used to, right? You know, I can remember going to computer class in high school and we were still learning how to type, right? So that is not a skill that you're really worried about teaching people nowadays.
Exactly.
So you've got tons of students who are so technologically adept and well-versed in technology and they've grown up with it their whole lives. They want to learn differently and they're comfortable learning differently. So VR for them is not like, oh, this is weird and I don't know how to navigate. It's fun, it's exciting, it's relevant, and it's tied into sort of how they've grown up most of their lives. So they're using VR to teach biology, and they've got these amazing simulations and these kind of realities that are created in there. It doesn't replace normal classroom learning, it doesn't replace having exams and all that stuff, but it's a supplement to it, and it's amazing. And you think about how that can be expanded out to other subjects. And I think even, you know, Arizona State's a huge institution, but think about like trade schools, technical colleges, where they might teach you architecture, engineering, building trades, all of that stuff. Imagine what it would be like to learn those skills in VR and then also apply them out in the factory setting or wherever it is that you're sort of mocking up buildings and doing that kind of stuff, right? You're getting hands-on training, but also that VR training, which is better than just reading out of a book. There's so many possibilities for that kind of thing. So the ASU example is amazing. And I think it also makes you think, okay, well, how do you take that and then scale it down, right? ASU is a beast, right? It's a huge institution that's just been at the forefront of innovation for a while with Michael Crow there at the head. But what about the small college? Like Ken's kind of example, you're in the middle of the country, small college, you have 1,500 students. Well, how do you leverage that, right? And how do you get involved in that? There's a lot that goes into that kind of a conversation too, which is how do we make it more affordable for those types of institutions and their resources? But there's so many possibilities there that it's just really exciting. So Ken, I'll turn it over to you if you've got some.
No, I'm glad you brought up that example. I was attending what is known as the ASU GSV event. I've attended that event for several years now. And if you ever want to see how big the education, but a large emphasis is on higher education ecosystem, just attend it. It just takes almost all the hotels out of San Diego out of play, that is. I was invited to the ASU Dreamscape event, and I participated in the demo. And what we went through the biology demonstration, and we were interacting with people all over the world in the virtual reality. You know, we were all there. I was interacting with somebody in Germany. I could touch them. I felt like I was right there with them. And you know, we all were at the same conference table. We were all interacting with lab tables, experimenting there, doing amazing things. And you took off the goggles going, you know, this world seems a little stale. That was rather fun. We all achieved a lot of interesting tasks along the way. I'm not a biologist. I mean, I took it in high school, but that was about it. It was fascinating. I think to answer your question, Bach, I think, what does it look like? I might embarrass myself now. Well, two things, and both will be embarrassing. When I was in college, I remember the fight for many, many, many months, maybe almost two quarters, where I went dealing with, were we going to allow calculators into the classroom? HP calculator, that's where they started to make their money. And it was going to cost me $99. And I'm going, where am I going to find that? Oh. And but the argument by faculty was no. And I was in the math program. And so when you're in a 45-minute class learning third differential partial equations, and you've got to do a lot of calculations, and you have to scribble it out by hand, you're wasting a lot of time doing the calculation and focusing a lot less time on what's the purpose of the equation.
Right.
<It's> like, so the students finally said, we'd kill to have something that will do that for us, to give us the number so we can, you can teach us on why the equation is what it is. Could you spend more time on that? It took a little time, and now look what's happened. It's just, but I remember that fight. That was a status quo kind of attitude that, you know, this shall not happen. I think you're going to see the same thing with AI. The example of Netflix and Blockbuster is always going to be a group that is still focused on what they think is working and it works best. But the future, I'll embarrass myself again. I'm a bit of a sci-fi geek. But when you're seeing a starship captain asking the computer to do the following or ask a question in simple language terms, and it's doing some amazing things behind that question, that's where we're going.
Right.
So is there an industry where learning to know how to build those AI, generative AI platforms is going to be, oh yeah, you're going to get paid a lot of money to build these things, no doubt.
Right.
But if you're a business person, you better know how to ask that captain's question succinctly, because it goes back to, I started in computer programming when it was all paper punch and paper tape, and the old adage still exists today.
Right.
And so if you're not aware of that, so I think you're going to see education learn, whether they want to or not, that this is where we're going. And I think it's going to be a blending of short-term programming that is stackable. And I think it's going to involve some, you know, specific technical skills that you might want to achieve. You know, if you want to learn how to do large language models, okay, there's a huge program for that. I just need to know how to manipulate AI for my work, and I want to get a better job using it. Okay, we've got a program for that too. But they're all stackable. They build to something. But I think it's going to be very different. It's not unlike a colleague of ours shared, remembering buying 33-inch long play albums. And you only wanted one song. And now I'm on Spotify and I hear a song going, yep, I want that one. Yep, I want that one. Yep, I want that one. They all build up into my album. I've got a phenomenal album. And there's I can ask it any kind of question. I'm looking for music this way, a little bit of Beach Boys. That's where we're going.
Right.
Yeah. Thinking about where we're going to, I'm always an optimist. And so want to, you know, share as we sort of get towards the end of our hour that we set aside here, the optimistic tone. If you just focus on like American higher ed and the birth rate and all that stuff, it's like, that doesn't sound very good, right? Really, really challenging times, maybe an easy future. But I love the global perspective too. So when you look globally, you know, birth rate declines in the US, but every day we're adding 200,000 people to the population in the world.
Right.
So we're going to add a billion people by 2030. When you look at data, Holon IQ, if you don't know them, if you're listening, I think based out of Australia, does incredible kind of data and sort of predictive data and all that stuff. They do higher ed, other industries. Some of their reports are absolutely worth a read, and their visuals are great too. They have projections on the growth of the global higher ed market. There is so much potential and so much demand for higher education globally. So let's step out of America in that context, where it's a little bit of a struggle right now for a bunch of different reasons that we mentioned, and just focus on the future. There are so many possibilities. What makes me excited is to think, okay, if you're one of these institutions in the US, how do you capitalize on that? Because there's also incredible demand for the American model of higher education. We have a colleague, Rick Joseph, who wrote a book about that. It's definitely worth a browse or a read. There's incredible demand for that model. So how do we take what we can do that's great here and bring it to these other parts of the world. So a lot of that growth for the global higher ed market is going to be Asia. It's going to be in Africa. How do we take what we do really well here, but actually bring it there in a way that is affordable, that benefits folks, that's sort of culturally sensitive? There's so many important pieces in there, but I think there's a lot. And that could be a whole podcast episode too, talking about global higher ed and all that stuff.
There's just so much
there. It's just really interesting to think about the future when you pull back to that next highest level. So not the national level, but the global worldwide level.
It's a really good point, Chris, because if you look at from a global perspective, there are so many new markets that are, you know, quickly looking to create a model of higher ed in their region, in their country, what have you. They could jumpstart. You know, we've got hundreds of years, millennia behind the traditional model. They can jumpstart and go right into something different and not have to carry along all of the inherent costs that they have to have had absorbed over the years. So I think I'm an optimist here as well. That's why I pivoted out of my career in IT for a long time and pivoted into higher ed. It is a great opportunity, but I think many are just going to have to take the blinders off. And as my old boss used to say, Ken, just imagine the possibilities, you know, enough of the negative energy. Think about the possibilities.
Exactly. And speaking of possibilities, I guess, you know, as I'm sort of reflecting on what you said, I'm truly inspired, you know, to hear this conversation, you know, happen. And, you know, looking at the future, a couple things that I'm seeing on my end, working with, you know, hundreds of leaders, you know, like yourself, I'm seeing, and if you kind of, you know, group them around maybe, you know, two or three sort of like themes or categories, for, you know, lack of a better word, you know, I'm seeing leverage, you know, leverage from, you know, resource perspective, right? You don't have to have, like you said, like if it's admissions, you don't have to have 10 admission people. You can have like shared services group that shares admissions, you know, so to speak, right?
So leverage the economies of scale. Yes.
That's one. You know, two, I'm seeing a lot of consolidation. I've been hearing talks, and I'm sure you have, you know, more fresh data on that. Some of the institutions are merging, you know, one buying another. It's happening in higher ed. It's happening in, you know, other, you know, fields, you know, as well. And I'm seeing less competition, but more collaboration, because technology is actually allowing us to do that, which, you know, reminds me of the next point, again, of the future that, you know, we are envisioning as well, is that, you know, back in the day, you know, if you wanted to have, wanted to become a subject, you know, matter expert, you know, on something, you had to like study really hard and, you know, put a lot of effort into it. And I kind of reflect on my early years of being in high school. We were lectured. We would literally, you know, under dictation, you know, would make like 10, 15 pages.
Yeah.
And then we would come back and retell what we learned. You know, right now, if you say, pull me a, you know, history page from X, Y, and Z, and then in the matter of like under a minute, you have everything you need. So I think it's truly changing, and AI is truly changing the way, you know, information is obtained. It's no longer, you know, your brain is not a storage of information. Your brain is more so like a processor of information to ask the good questions that you mentioned, right? You know, the other thing I'm really fascinated about is as well, you mentioned a ship. You know, yes, you know, what if something goes wrong with that ship? What if you don't know what that code looked like? So you still need education. You still need awareness, right? You still need those, you know, skills to be able to twist
they
it.
Better be on board.
Turn it off or turn it on or twist it. And yeah, I think I'd like to say that I was truly amazed and, you know, really learned a lot from you both today. And I'm sure our listeners did as well. As we're wrapping up this episode, is there one piece of wisdom or a lesson learned you want to share either to an educator or to an administrator or a student?
I will say, and I'll try not to repeat what I said last time, but I'm a true believer in embracing change. And it's really hard. And I know I said this last time, it's really, really hard. We don't always do a good job as human beings in evolving and changing sort of on the fly, but that doesn't change the fact that you need to. You shouldn't be trying to go backwards to the way things were. You should be going, okay, well, the landscape's changed, the world's changed. It's not going to go backwards. It's going to continue to change. So what do we need to do to get in line with that and continue forward? And for folks out there who are wondering, you know, are we on the outside edge of this credentialing thing? Are we, where do we fit? I think somewhere close to 90% of institutions from a survey I saw, or at least from their leaders, said, you know, we very strongly agree that alternative credentials, micro credentials, badges, whatever terminology you want to use there. That's part of our future. So right. Know that you're well aligned if that's where you're trying to put a lot of your focus right now with what everybody else is trying to do. And just to come back to what you just mentioned, Bach, around the competition versus collaboration thing, I don't think that competition is the answer anymore, right? And I think that's different for higher ed for a long time. I think there was a lot of competition for students in this sense of sort of trying to kind of keep pace and outpace your neighbor. Now it's like, that's probably not going to work for you because students have so much more choice because of technology.
Right.
You can live in one place and enroll somewhere else and get a great education, right? And it can be delivered quickly and exactly how you want it to be. And so a lot of the barriers that used to exist and the things that used to keep us sort of regionally focused or even focused within our state in terms of education, those are gone. And so people have to figure out how to work together. That takes great leadership at the board level. It takes great leadership at the institutional level. It takes collaboration between those entities. They have to be in lockstep and aligned on what the future is. So I see great potential, great opportunity. It's going to be hard for a lot of folks, but you can do it. Ken?
That's amazing. That's a great piece of advice, Ken.
Oh, you did that so well, Chris. I'm very impressed. I'll do my best to pile on to that because I think that's right on. I think two things for those that are watching this and you're looking to reskill or what have is we've already talked about, and you're typically going to be searching via this device or the device we're on, a laptop or a tablet or what have you. I would argue the following. If that institution or that entity, that commercial entity, if they can't capture your attention and get you signed up in those first 2 to 3 to 5 minutes, move on, because they may not be ready to do what you're hoping they can do for you. If they can't help you get that degree or credential starting point with you during that conversation, you know, think twice about it. Keep shopping, because there are a lot of entities out there that are doing it very well. So be careful. The other thing is with regard to the future, Chris and I do a lot of strategic planning initiatives. The first thing I do whenever I get into a boardroom, what have you, is if it's, especially if it's an institution, I basically say, okay, for your freshmen this year, what does the world look like in 2028? And what are you sending them into? My point being is I always start them out 5 to 10 years in the future, which is super important to say, let's spend the next hour or two just talking about what that looks like, because then we got to work backwards. And if we're wrong, that's okay. You know, you can adjust the plan along the way. Believe it or not, this is what the military does all the time. That's why they have these things called war colleges. They envision the possibilities in the future and then play it out, see what it looks like. We could learn a lot from that. So, and I'll go back to what I said again, imagine the possibilities. That's my summary.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Ken and Chris, what's the best way to find you for our podcast listeners who are interested and, you know, would love to connect with you? Please leave us with good contact information, and we'll also, you know, share that as a part of the episode notes.
Sure. LinkedIn is always great. Try to be active on there. I can't say I'm the best in the world, but I'm not the worst either. It ebbs and flows depending on how busy I am. But Chris, C-H-R-I-S Maloney, M-O-L-O-N-E-Y, on LinkedIn, you should be able to find me there. My email, if you have a question, if you work for a college university, you have questions, you want to talk with us, C, my first letter, C, M-O-L-O-N-E-Y at agb.org.
Excellent.
And for me, I would say the same thing for LinkedIn. I try to be active, but I always will take a message, no worries there. And it's on LinkedIn. I'm Ken Knieven. I think I'm the only one there. So go for that. And if you have more interest, my work email is K Knieven, first initial K, last name Knieven. Hopefully that'll be brought out at core.edu. And feel free to reach me either way. Happy to respond to you anytime.
Excellent. Ken and Chris, thank you so much for your time. And I appreciate Forestay's sponsoring of this, you know, episode. Learn more about Forestay and the work that we do with higher education institutions. We're on a mission to create home away from home and helping institutions to transform the on and off campus housing. Chris and Ken, thank you so much. Until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Education and Empowerment Podcast. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com.